I am Dr. Nina Kim, currently working at the University of Washington. I am an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. This talk I will be focusing on acute hepatitis C infection, specifically the epidemiology, clinical features, and diagnosis. So let's start by talking about acute hepatitis C epidemiology. So this is the map that is put out by the Centers for Disease Control, where they look at the number of estimated cases. This is looking at 1982 through 2010. And you can see here that we've made some major progress. In 1982 through the early part of the 1990s, we had in the range of 30 to 48,000 new cases. And it's come down substantially, particularly in the mid-1990s. And a large part of this is likely due to more widespread hepatitis C testing. We got better at screening blood donors as well as blood products. And to some extent, this was also due in part to increased awareness and testing of individuals at risk. But let's look a little bit more closely at the last decade from 2000 to 2010. And now this is different. In the y-axis, you can see that instead of estimated number of new cases, we're looking at the number of reported cases. And this is distinctly different and lower than and the prior slide. And in 2010, for example, the number of estimated infections was on the range of 2,800. And here, the number of reported cases is actually just over 850. And so when you look at the incident cases in 2010, so based on prevalence and other modeling data, the Centers for Disease Control estimates that there are about 17,000 new cases of hepatitis C per year. And then you look down at the folks who show up with acute symptomatic infection, and that's about 2,800, the folks who actually sort of present for care. And then you drill down further at the number of cases that are actually reported, and you see that the number drops even further. And I think the biggest drop, of course, is from the estimated number of new cases, 17,000, to 2,800. And what I hope to convince you is that we really need to try to identify the majority of new infections for two reasons. One, because this is a group we can capture and do early risk reduction counseling, early linkage to care. And it's important to remember that the majority, 75 to 85% of these new infections are going to go on to chronic persistent infection without treatment. And that if we actually capture them in new infection, in this period of acute infection, we can actually reduce this percentage. And that I hope to convince you that capturing patients in acute infection is really a golden opportunity to shift the dynamics of natural history. So in order to recognize acute hep C infection, it's important to know how it's transmitted, to recognize what exposures and scenarios put the patient at risk. It's important to remember that bloodborne transmission is the most common route of spread. Sexual transmission is really considered rare, particularly when you're thinking about the general population. And by general population, I'm talking about heterosexual population. And this is based on longitudinal epidemiologic data. This was one study that was published a number of years back in the American Journal of Gastroenterology. And they looked at a cohort of 895 serodiscordant monogamous couples and followed them out for 10 years. So we had something on the order of 80,000 person years of data, so that's quite a long period of follow-up. And only three transmissions occurred amongst these couples, with an incident rate as you see here. And of these three transmission events, strain analysis, molecular analysis did not actually support intraspousal or sexual transmission, and that it was likely that these individuals acquired their hepatitis C from other sources, potentially parenteral sources. However, it is important to acknowledge that we do see, and we have seen increasing reports of sexually acquired acute hep C amongst HIV-infected men who have sex with men. The initial reports came out in Europe. We are now seeing reports in Australia and U.S., other regions. And so this is a population that is at particular risk for sexually acquired acute hep C, and it's important to keep that in mind. I'll also add that another sort of less common mode of transmission is vertical transmission. So infants can get hepatitis C from their chronically infected mothers. The occurrence of this transmission is actually not that common. It's on the order of less than 5%. So this is just a list of potential hepatitis C exposures. It's important to keep these in mind when you're thinking about clinical scenarios that put patients at risk. And of course, recent injection drug use, new injection drug use is definitely a big risk factor. Needle stick injury, particularly in the case of healthcare workers, procedures that put the patient at risk for potentially reused needles. So recreationally, thinking about in terms of tattooing, body piercing, exposure to reuse sharp objects. So all of these components or exposures can put the person at risk. When we're thinking about potential sexual exposures, particularly in the realm of men who have sex with men, there have been a number of high-risk sexual practices: fisting, bleeding during sex, multiple partners, concurrent sexually transmitted infections that will put a patient at risk for acute hep C infection. And of course, having a known source partner that is hep C infected is certainly a major risk factor. So these are some examples. The last item, blood transfusion or unsafe therapeutic procedures during travel in a developing country. I would say not only during travel, but if you're coming from a developing country, and I mention this because, we live in a global society and we have a lot of migration, and a number of my patients that I see in the hepatitis clinic really have no clear identifiable risk factor other than the fact that they got exposed to needles and vaccines along the way when they were getting routine medical care in their country of origin. So that is certainly something to be aware of. So let's switch gears and talk about diagnosis. So diagnosis of acute hepatitis C. So formally, the definition of acute hepatitis C infection is really that first 6 months of infection. And the diagnosis can be challenging for a couple of reasons. One that I pointed out, most cases are asymptomatic. It's really only a minority of cases that actually show up with sort of the classic symptoms that you tend to think of for acute hepatitis. Additionally, there is really no clear-cut, reliable, specific IgM-based assay. So we don't really have a test formally that says, okay, this test is positive, we know the patient has been recently infected. We don't actually have that currently for acute hepatitis C, and that's important to remember. So this is the formal CDC case definition for acute hepatitis C, and you'll see here that it's based on two criteria, clinical and laboratory. Clinical is having an acute illness that's consistent with acute viral hepatitis and either jaundice, dark urine, or jaundice coupled with dark urine, or an ALT, a serum ALT that exceeds 400. Now, keep in mind that all of these things are fairly vague and nonspecific. There are lots of things that symptoms that can mimic acute viral hepatitis. There are lots of things that can cause jaundice and ALT elevation, alcohol being a very common one. So you need this needs to be linked up with laboratory criteria. And for acute hepatitis C definition to be met, really, it is one of three possible positives. So either you have an antibody-based assay, which is the EIA is an enzyme immunoassay, which is the standard test that we send when we're sending a screening test for hepatitis C antibody. So that's positive or the REBA is positive. The REBA is just another version of an antibody test. It's more of a second-tier test that is a little bit more specific, not as widely available, but if that's positive, that's also strongly convincing. And as I'll go over, you're going to have some patients who have not yet developed antibody in acute and early infection. And so there would be some individuals who have a very convincing picture for acute hepatitis C. Their antibody is negative, but you have to send an RNA test, so a viral-based PCR assay. If that is positive, that's also very convincing, particularly when it's coupled with a negative antibody test that later becomes positive. And of course, once you've determined there's hepatitis C present, either by antibody or RNA, you additionally have to exclude the possibility of acute hepatitis A and acute hepatitis B, and that's where the final criteria comes in, is that you have to have a negative Hep A IgM and a negative Hep B core IgM. So that is formally the definition. So let's go through the different components of the lab testing. So for the viral assay is the first thing that shows up. And there are two flavors or versions of the viral assay that can be sent. I think it's easy enough and more readily available these days to send a quantitative assay. So that's fine, and we have very sensitive quantitative assays. I don't think you gain more with one or the other. So it can be a quantitative or qualitative assay, depending on what's available to you. And this is, you can detect hepatitis C viral RNA as early as a week from the time of infection. So this is really the first thing that shows up, and it's the most sensitive early test. The levels can fluctuate widely in acute infections, so that I think is a relevant point, particularly when we had less sensitive assays, where you might have captured the patient sort of below the limit of detection. But I think currently the currently available RNA assays that are out there really do, most of them have a low limit of detection these days. And that's really what you want to aim for if you're trying to diagnose hepatitis C, is a low limit of detection assay, a very sensitive assay where the limit is about 10 to 15 international units per mil. So the next thing that really becomes abnormal is the serum ALT, and in symptomatic patients, it's generally elevated in the range of 400 to 800 units per liter. But it's important to keep in mind, despite the CDC criteria, that really any new unexplained elevation, typically exceeding 7 times the upper limits of normal, or certainly exceeding 7 times the patient's baseline, should immediately pique your suspicion of potential acute viral hepatitis, specifically hepatitis C if the patient has a history of exposures. And then, of course, the antibody assay. And here I'm talking about the standard enzyme immunoassay, the EIA. This turns positive later. It often lags behind the hep C RNA. In most patients, it can be detected about 2 to 4 months from the time of infection. But it's important to keep in mind that some patients, for example, HIV-infected patients who have advanced disease, their seroconversion may occur later. So the fact that they're not turning antibody positive should not dissuade you, especially if in the context of a positive viral RNA, that this patient is acutely infected. It's important to remember it's not as sensitive. Only about 50 to 70% of acutely infected patients, depending on where you're capturing them in the time frame, are going to be hep C antibody positive. And it's certainly helpful to date the infection and sort of zero in on potential time if there's seroconversion that's occurred. If you had a patient who had said, let's say they happened to have gotten screening for hepatitis C antibody and they told you, oh, I was hep C antibody negative, several months ago, and now they're turning positive, that's, you've pretty much documented seroconversion right there, and you've got a recent infection in your hands. So this is a schematic profile of these three labs across the first 20 weeks of infection, and the sequences is outlined. You can see here the hep C viral RNA in blue is what shows up first, and we can see quite high levels. The symptoms, so if patients are going to present with symptoms, they tend to present typically around the time where the ALT peaks. So you can see here that sort of the host immunologic response, sort of the inflammatory response in the liver, lags a little bit behind. It tends to occur right around the time when the viral level is starting to decline. And you can see here that the ALT rise or the peak tends to coincide with the symptoms. And then, of course, in red, you see that hep C antibody really just shows up much later in the realm of the 3 month mark in most patients. And that initially, the levels may not be very high, so you might actually get a false negative result when even in that beginning period when the antibodies are beginning to form. So it is always worth repeating the hep C antibody in a patient that you're sufficiently suspicious may have acute infection, particularly in the context of a positive RNA. So this is a schema of what occurs with hepatitis C when the infection persists. And of course, as I mentioned, this occurs in 75 to 85% of people if you leave them alone, if you just let natural history take its course. And you can see here that you could see the viral fluctuations in blue. Again, you can see in green, the ALT can peak usually in the 2 to 3 month period from the time of exposure. Symptoms occur in that time frame. And the antibody again shows up around the same time. But in this case, the viral level will generally equilibrate and stay persistent. A couple of clues in terms of thinking about viral level. This was actually a study done that looked at a recently incarcerated population and had identified folks who met clinical exposure criteria for acute hepatitis, and they also had a group of folks with chronic established infection, and they compared what their viral levels look like. And you can see here in the x-axis sort of the range. This is in log, so log 10 viral RNA levels. So you can see here that 80% of acutely infected patients, so these are the blue bars, had hep C viral levels that were less than 10 to the 5 IU per mil. So that's less than 100,000. So they tended to have, on average, lower viral levels than those who were chronically infected in green. And that additionally, the viral dynamics were kind of interesting. So this group followed these patients out serially, checked their viral levels at a month, a few months, and then I think 6 months from the time of infection, and found that the viral load fluctuated greatly. And in 86% of acutely infected patients, they fluctuated more than a log. And that's less usual. It's only about a third of chronically infected patients who really have significant fluctuations between hep C viral measurements. So these are clues that, in addition to some of the sort of the clinical information and ALT elevations, that can let you know one way or the other whether someone might be acutely infected. So let's go through the clinical features and natural history. So when we're talking about folks who do have symptoms, these are among the most common ones. This was a study that was published in Gastroenterology in 2003, and you can see here that majority of these patients, just over two-thirds, had jaundice. A significant majority also had flu-like symptoms. Some of these patients actually manifested hyperbilirubinemia with the classic sort of dark urine, pale stools, and nausea and abdominal pain occurred in more of a minority of these folks. This was another study of 24 patients who presented with symptoms, and you can see here that it was similar. 63% just presented with fatigue, and it was only a minority of folks who actually had, you know, full-fledged jaundice or some of those gastrointestinal symptoms. I would say, you know, you guys should look at these two graphs with a bit of a grain of salt. It's important to remember that these studies that look at symptoms and signs really are not representative of all patients with acute hep C, and that there's clearly some self-selection or referral bias here. So these are cases that showed up. They showed up to the clinic because they were sick, and it's important to remember that many of those who are acutely infected are not sick enough to present for care. So these were people who were sick enough to present for care, and these were the type of symptoms they had. So when we're thinking about acute hepatitis C infection, the incubation period for from the time of infection to the development of symptoms is anywhere from 4 to 14 weeks. So it's quite a wide range. Most of those, as I mentioned, with acute infection are asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic. They might have, you know, just some mild fatigue as their only symptom. And it's only 10 to 20% that have a distinct clinical illness, as described in the last few slides. If clinical illness occurs, it's important to remember that hepatitis is rarely fulminant in the case of acute hep C. You don't, as I mentioned, the ALT typically peaks in the 400 to 1,000 range. Really, and this is quite distinct from acute hepatitis A or B, where the majority of people with clinical illness will actually have ALT in the several thousand range, so definitely exceeding 1,000. And it is rare in acute hepatitis C for your total bilirubin to exceed 12. And a reflection of this sort of milder severity of illness is kind of the tip of the iceberg example, is that when you look at liver transplant series for people who present with acute fulminant liver failure from viral hepatitis, you can see here that the majority of cases are actually acute viral hepatitis A or B, and you rarely, if ever, see acute hepatitis C requiring liver transplant. So you have this patient who's acutely infected, and you follow them along, and there are really only two possible outcomes here. One is spontaneous clearance. So some people are lucky enough, about 20 to 25% of individuals are lucky enough to have mounted a sufficient host inflammatory host immune response to be able to clear their infection on their own. This percentage of folks who have spontaneous clearance may actually be lower in someone who's HIV infected. And then, of course, the remainder of those folks will have chronic persistent infection. There are some predictors for who is going to go on to spontaneous hep C clearance. These are some examples, so we can get some clues when we're following these folks. If we're seeing a lower peak hep C viral level, definitely if folks are under kind of the 10,000 range, that should suggest to you that they might actually be able to clear their infection. If you're seeing a very rapid decline in those initial viral kinetics as you're following these folks out, and they're getting to the point where they look like they're clearing their infection, that's also very helpful. It turns out that folks who have more severe infections, so really high ALTs and the presence of jaundice, actually are favorable factors for whether you're going to go on to have spontaneous clearance. And there are some demographic factors. Folks who are younger, women more often than men will have spontaneous clearance. And folks who are not African American, so non-black race, has been linked with spontaneous clearance. The co-infection with chronic hepatitis B, it turns out, there's this phenomenon called viral interference, and it turns out that if you already have active hep B replication going on, it actually interferes with hep C replication, and it might predispose the patient to spontaneously clear their hepatitis C, which would be lucky for them because you don't want co-infection with both viruses. And then, of course, the IL-28B genotype, so the CC homozygous genotype. So I wanted to spend some time just mentioning this as a potential host predictor for whether you're going to clear your infection. This was a genetic polymorphism that was identified by investigators at Johns Hopkins, and they found that this gene, which encodes interleukin 21, I believe, has very strong predictive value for whether someone's going to clear with treatment or whether they're going to clear just, you know, spontaneously after they become acutely infected. And you can see here that those who have a CC homozygous genotype are over twofold likely to clear their infection compared to those who have a TT or CT genotype. And we can actually test for this. There's molecular-based testing now, and it is commercially available to screen for this. And you can see here, this is looking at percentage of clearance based on, so in the left grouping, it's all patients, and then you can see that we stratify based on races and based on what their IL-28B genotype is. And you can see here that this IL-28B genotype explains a good part of why we're seeing some of the racial disparities with respect to spontaneous clearance. So it can be fairly predictive of whether someone's going to go on to clear. And this is relevant because, you know, we need to decide whether this person needs to get treated or not, or whether we can just follow them out and see how they do. And that's, of course, a topic for another discussion. So in summary, acute hepatitis C is often a misdiagnosis. Contaminated blood exposure remains the most common way, mode of transmission, but sexual transmission can occur, particularly among HIV-infected MSM. Confirmation of acute hepatitis C can be challenging because only a minority of patients have clinical symptoms. And the cornerstone of acute hep C diagnosis in terms of labs are really the viral RNA-based assay, a serum ALT, and a hep C antibody. And it's important to remember that spontaneous clearance can occur, but it is important to follow these folks out because the majority of patients can go on to chronic infection if they are untreated, and they might. This is a golden opportunity. These folks are a lot more responsive to treatment than if we capture them a lot later in chronic established infection. So it's important to identify these individuals. So with that, I will end.